This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. And today, we are happy to have you with us for our radio and online Main Street across the state to talk again about the big story of 2020 and the story that looms large still in 2021, COVID-19. Today, we're going to talk with a couple of principals at one of the smaller hospitals in North Dakota, Unity Medical Center in Grafton. We're joined by Alan O'Neill. He is the CEO. Alan, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And Dr. Matthew Vecito, he's the chief medical officer. Dr. Vecito, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. Good day.
Alan, we'll start with you. The BBC aired a television story in late November about your hospital dealing with a surge of COVID-19 patients. How would you describe your situation today?
We don't really even want to say out loud, but our situation has improved considerably. Our numbers have declined significantly, and I really feel that perhaps the governor's mask mandate helped. I think people are being more cautious and practicing better with social distancing and all of the other things that go along with that. So we're cautiously optimistic at this point, but not overly long-term, because I know there's a second strain of coronavirus that is much more contagious that's making its way around the country. So we're hoping and praying that we've seen the worst.
Dr. Vecito, how prepared were you and Unity for the COVID when it broke out?
Once it finally hit our area, we were actually pretty prepared. We had started making arrangements and contingency plans way back in the spring and early summer. And unfortunately, our surge did not occur until much later than that. We really didn't see a significant uptick in hospitalized patients in our area until well into the fall. So by that time, we had a number of plans and options already in place. So by the time we had a significant sort of surge in hospitalized patients into the October-November timeframe, we were pretty well prepared for that.
What limitations did your facility have for treating patients with severe cases of COVID?
Well, one of the limitations that a rural hospital operates under is because we're a relatively low-volume facility, we typically do not keep sicker patients that require care that would normally be given in an intensive care unit. So as cases in the region and surrounding areas surged, our receiving hospitals were overloaded, and therefore the possibility of having to take sicker patients, or rather keep sicker patients because they could not take them, went up. So one of our big concerns was being able to prepare for the possibility of having to keep a patient that is sicker than we would normally keep in our facility. There was a lot of sort of stress and anxiety for staff before that point, because the possibility of having to keep patients that are much sicker than you're used to taking care of can cause stress. So that was one of the issues that we kind of had to deal with ahead of time, to say it's very possible that we're going to have to start keeping people that are much more critical than we would normally do so because our receiving facilities are overloaded.
When the BBC report came out, and it was around Thanksgiving in November, there were a reported 7 intensive care unit beds available statewide on that day. Does Unity care for ICU patients?
Not typically. We do not. When we submit to the state, we do not count any of our beds as an ICU bed.
Have you had patients on respirators?
We have not had to keep anybody that was intubated on a respirator. We have had to do what we call positive pressure support with an external mask type of ventilation, which is something that we will do normally for short periods of time. If somebody goes on to that type of support and does well and is able to come off, then they will sometimes stay. But typically somebody that is that severe will then get transferred out. But we did have to keep some people on that type of ventilatory support for longer than we normally would. We did not end up having to have anybody stay here on a ventilator.
Alan, give us a little lay of the land here. Many hospitals are part of larger networks. Are Unity and its Park River Clinic standalone facilities, or do you have relationships with other medical facilities?
Actually, we are. We are an independent organization, which is kind of rare in this day and age. We do have relationships with larger tertiary facilities. Altru is our primary one. Obviously, we're about 45 minutes from Grand Forks, but we also have with Sanford, Essentia, and not so much with CHI. They're a little bit farther west. But yes, we do have relationships, but we are independent. We basically row our own boat, so to speak.
Dr. Vecito, you were featured in that BBC report, and also a number of nurses were, and they were clearly overworked and under stress. Did many of your staff members come down with COVID?
We did not have anybody get critically ill, I would say, but we had a number of staff members that did end up becoming infected. Fortunately, none that we are aware of that became infected from patients or at work. But during the height of that surge, there was so much of it in the community, we were actually able to trace everyone's contact, where it came from, or where they were likely exposed. So we had a number of nurses that did become infected and were unable to work for a period of time because of their quarantine. So not only were our volumes increased, but we also were short-staffed just by sheer numbers because there were people that were not able to work and cover their shifts because of exposure or infection.
My numbers are that the hospital, Unity Hospital, has 14 beds and 41 staff. Is that approximately correct?
I believe that's probably 41 nurses on staff. We have 140-something employees, but that's probably our nursing pool.
Have you seen the vaccine yet? It's been rolled out nationwide. There have been some hiccups in the rollout. Have you had any vaccine at Unity yet?
Yep, we were allocated 100 doses that arrived on December 22nd. I had one of the first of those doses. Alan was right before me, but we have rolled it out, and we've given almost 100 doses total now, I believe it is. We're allocated to get some more, and of course, it's a two-dose series, so all of us are scheduled to have our second dose 28 days after the first dose we received.
And since you've experienced the vaccine, you are one of those very rare and unique people right now. How would you describe the experience? Were there any effects to it, like occasionally you have with a flu vaccine?
I personally did not have any significant adverse effects. I had a sore arm. It was for about 4 days, a little longer than I would normally expect to see with a tetanus shot. But nothing systemic. I had no fever, no body aches, nothing at all. And the vast majority of our staff have reported that.
Alan, do you think most people in the Grafton area will get the vaccine?
I think there's a high number that will. There's a lot of interest in it. There is always going to be some that are skeptical or reluctant, and that's true with any vaccines. But I think there's such an interest in this that I think there will be a lot of our participation when it becomes available for everyone.
Dr. Vecito, has Unity Hospital had to make any adjustments to procedures to apply lessons learned from the pandemic?
That's an interesting question. I think we're still in the midst of the pandemic, but I'm very curious to see what everyday life is after the pandemic has either started to really taper down or has passed. I don't think we're going to see mask wearing in public forever, but I think you're going to see mask wearing in hospitals for direct care staff a lot more commonly. I've started posing the question to my colleagues recently, what have we been doing for the last 200 years, sticking our faces in sick people's faces? You know, open your mouth and cough while I stick my face in your mouth. It makes no sense whatsoever. So I think a lot of that stuff is probably going to stick around. Some of our cleaning procedures and that sort of thing, we probably will continue the way we're doing it for COVID. But some of the infectious disease practices and contact precautions and that sort of thing, the way we've had to modify our use of PPE to conserve it for patients with COVID or possible COVID, I'm very interested to see what comes of all of that after this pandemic has tapered off.
Alan O'Neill is the CEO of Unity Medical Center, and Dr. Matthew Vecito, you just heard his voice, is Chief Medical Officer. Alan, you referenced earlier the masks and social distancing that eventually were mandated. Have you had any instances with people who just simply wanted to make their political point known at your facility?
No, not in the facility, because we restrict access to those that, we've gone through several gyrations of that with visitation. At first, we did not have any visitation, as most healthcare organizations did. Then we had one visitor, family, or compassionate visits, things like that. But we require that everyone entering the facility wears a mask. And I really think the compliance is improving and the acceptance overall. When I see, folks downtown and whatnot, you see a lot more people wearing masks than was prevalent a couple months ago. So I think people are accepting it as a pretty common practice.
I mentioned that that BBC report that's a couple of months ago now had nurses who were clearly stressed. And I'm just questioning, how do you deal with that? It's not a big hospital. You've got those 40-some nurses, and they're the frontline workers, and they're clearly going through a very difficult time. How do you help them?
I think the best thing is communication and being there for them. That was at a time when we were at our max. We had repurposed several waiting areas in the facility to accommodate patients, including our chapel and a family waiting room down by the cafeteria. And it was draining. It was emotionally, physically draining for everyone. And luckily that the numbers have gone down since then. So we've all been able to catch our breath, so to speak. And I'm sure Dr. Vercito can add something to this too.
One of the things the administration, I think, has done very well here was to make very obvious the fact that we appreciate our staff and we understand that they've been stressed. They made cafeteria meals free to staff. They discounted a lot of the items in the cafeteria. The community really pitched in and started sending. There was almost a free meal a day for a while there, and at the very least one or two a week during the height after that BBC story came out, and just supporting our staff and letting them know they were appreciated. And a lot of that has gone a really long way to help the staff get that, yes, they're stressed, but they're supported, and I think that's helped. I sent a message out at one point just reminding everyone that we are all stressed and we're all sort of at our wit's end, and that remember that in your interactions, because you're stressed, but so is the person next to you, and you can't even begin to guess how that person's handling all this. We had a lot of conversations on that note. So a number of things, like we were mentioning, just support from the administration, support from the community, and trying to be understanding to the stress everyone's been going through really went a long way. And our staff did a great job, as I thought they would.
The impression I got from that report was that at that time, a lot of the patients that you were dealing with COVID, were elderly people, nursing home residents in some cases. Is that accurate, or were you seeing all kinds of ages?
We did see people of all ages. We had a couple of younger people with very few other medical problems end up hospitalized. Of course, the vast majority were older patients with comorbidities, but we did, in fact, see that sort of gamut of patients where even some younger people without other medical problems did end up hospitalized with very low oxygenation and support for quite some time.
At the peak of this, were Grafton area nursing homes overwhelmed with this disease?
Yes.
And how would you assess the circumstance today?
Well, essentially, it seems like everybody there became infected, and therefore now the numbers are low because there's no one left that hasn't had it in the last 3 months. With vaccine being rolled out, that's not going to become a recurrent issue. They did, unfortunately, have a very large percentage of patients not only infected but become significantly ill with it, and unfortunately a significant number of deaths.
And in many cases, these elderly patients might have come from a nursing home to the hospital where they would have been isolated and would have passed away alone. Is that not the case?
That is the case. We had a few people where that was the case. Unfortunately, we did make compassionate care exceptions for visitors, and we did have family members gown up in protective equipment and visit their loved ones at the bedside because we were concerned that they would ultimately die from it. So it was difficult because you want to weigh compassion versus safety for both the patient and the family member. So those were tough decisions.
Alan, Grafton, North Dakota is near the Canadian border. It's in a very rural area to most people who live in the United States. Is it hard to find staff? Is it hard to recruit, for example, nurses to Unity?
I think that's a common problem with all hospitals in the United States. Fortunately, we've been done pretty well with recruiting of nurses. We do have presently a few openings, but we seem to have navigated that fairly well. I think it helps to be so close to Grand Forks, 45 minutes away. You could make a comment that we're kind of a bedroom community of Grand Forks, so the commute is better, but we've done pretty well. But yeah, we've had some shortages. We have two travelers here right now, but I know a lot of organizations that have brought in a lot more nursing staff to help out.
Rural hospitals have been reported under financial stress for years. How is Unity doing?
You know, we are doing okay. We did a lot of the rural hospitals, the CARES Act, the dollars that were made available by the federal government helped us get through this. So I guess we'll see where it settles out in the long run, because we can't predict the trajectory of this thing, how long it's going to go and when it's going to resurface, because the federal government won't keep doing that. So right now we're holding our own, I'll say.
Well, the COVID pandemic is one thing. The CARES Act to respond to it is another. But over the long run, would you like to see changes in healthcare policy to help facilities like yours?
That's a very broad question. I think the way that the critical access structure was established in 1997, the Balanced Budget Act, you know, it does reimburse us on allowable costs for direct patient care for Medicare patients. It's important to keep that concept in place. Medicaid expansion has helped us a lot. You know, we're one of the states that chose to have Medicaid expansion, and we need to keep that in place because that provided a safety net for our patients and helped us financially eliminate a lot of bad debt.
Dr. Facito, how did you come to Unity Medical Center?
I actually came by way of Allen. I was in private practice in Grand Forks on my own for several years, and I knew Allen in that time period. And over the course of 1 or 2 years, he convinced me that Unity was a great place to work, and I'm very thankful to have found out that he is absolutely correct.
Well, looking back on 2020 and the pandemic and all of the stress that it created, has this been the most unusual medical experience of your life? Do you ever expect to have anything like this confront you again?
By far the most unique and unexpected experience of my medical career, which is now about 20 years. I started medical school in 2001, and nothing could possibly have prepared us as a medical community for something of this breadth. You can't predict it. The word unprecedented has pretty much been worn out, but it is absolutely correct. And, you know, it's unlikely that we'll see something like this in a lifetime. You know, a lot of comparisons and parallels have been drawn to the Spanish flu epidemic of the late 1918 to 1919 period. And, you know, medicine is such a different, entirely different industry now than it was then. The parallels are very difficult to draw other than the infection numbers and that sort of thing. But this is not something that we ever addressed in medical school. There was no even single lecture about how to handle an epidemic or a pandemic of this nature. So,
given the uniqueness of this circumstance and the fact that you're a medical professional, do you have any kind of insight into when we might actually have some semblance of normal return to everyday life, keeping in mind that the pandemic hasn't even been a year yet in our country?
That, I think, is the golden question, really. We're still waiting on some data to really be able to give an accurate estimate of that, because we're not 100% sure what herd immunity looks like yet. We don't know for sure how long immunity is going to be given by the vaccine. We're not 100% sure in understanding exactly what immunity from infection looks like. We know that people are getting some degree of natural immunity from having been infected, but it doesn't last me forever. And some patients who got quite sick will have better antibody response than those that either didn't have any symptoms or only had mild illness. So a lot of it is going to depend on what happens with the vaccine, as well as what percentage of people get the vaccine. Even if the vaccine does not allow for permanent immunity, if you get enough percentage of the population immune all at once, numbers will fall and stay down. Even if we do end up having to recommend repeat vaccination, whether it be annually like influenza vaccine or more or less frequently than that, if you can get a significant portion of the population immunized, then numbers will go down and stay low. But we do, unfortunately, not have a really great idea exactly what time period that's going to occur in, because we don't know for sure what percent of the population is going to get the vaccine.
Nationwide, approximately 20% of the U.S. population received their health care from a rural provider. And in North Dakota, that's more than the case, because of the 42 acute care hospitals in North Dakota, 36 of them are critical access. So the rural footprint and the delivery system in the rural areas were very challenged all during the COVID crisis, and we're doing our best to hold our own.
Dr. Matthew Vecito is Chief Medical Officer for Unity Medical Center in Grafton. Dr. Vecito, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And Alan O'Neill, the Chief Executive Officer at Unity Medical, thank you as well.
You're very welcome, and thank you for your time.
More Main Street in a moment.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra is for people who treasure music and the arts. Hi, I'm Maestro Beverly Everett. We're performing our full concert schedule this season. Details are subject to change. Don't miss Red Carpet Renegades, January 15th and 16th, our popular annual cinema concert featuring favorite movie themes. For up-to-date concert and ticket information, visit BismarckMandanSymphony.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Mark Trahant is a seasoned journalist and editor. He taught journalism at the University of North Dakota before leaving to edit the online news service Indian Country Today. He also provides commentaries that we share on Main Street, and today's has a provocative title about a current event, insurrection.
The extraordinary history of Donald Trump is coming to an end. The attempted insurrection on Capitol Hill last week will be the near final note. Mobs of pro-Trump thugs assaulted the very idea of democracy, forcing members of Congress into secure locations. And we now know how close this whole affair came to an even more lethal day, with some of the provocateurs promising to kidnap or kill the vice president, members of Congress, and their staff. What normally would have been a ceremonial act, the counting of the Electoral College votes, became a mission of supreme importance, a reinforcement of the democratic process itself. What now? In about a week, there will be a new president and vice president, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. There is also resolution. The Biden administration now has a political honeymoon that will allow changes that might not have been possible just a week ago. This should mean that nominees for cabinet positions will have an easier time winning confirmation, even if much later than normal. Representative Deb Haaland, for example, might have had a tough hearing given her views on oil and gas in a department that will regulate much of that industry on public lands. But that kind of opposition has collapsed. The election of 1800 is often called America's Second Revolution because of upheaval. The election was bitterly disputed, and the losing side was ready to burn the government down in disgust, and they tried. The War Department and the Treasury Department were torched. But that insurrection did not work, and it divided the Federalist Party so effectively that it ceased to exist. One party leader, Alexander Hamilton, blamed another leader, President John Adams, for being unworthy of office. He said his failed term was traced to the ungovernable temper of Mr. Adams. Already, you are seeing this unfold in the Republican Party. Senators and representatives that voted to contest the election, even after all of the violence, are losing political allies, funding, and even publishing deals as a consequence. Another consequence is there will be a new discussion about race and law and order. The images of rioters taking selfies with Capitol Police are a stark contrast to the familiar scenes from Standing Rock to Mount Rushmore to the more recent Black Lives Matter protests across the country. The uneven nature of justice must be addressed. It's now essential to the survival of the United States and the rule of law. Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, White Earth Nation, told a powerful story about what this all means. She said she was struggling how to explain what happened to her 7-year-old daughter. The terror that our elected representatives, their staff, and journalists covering democracy in action felt today is hard to comprehend, she said. The choice in front of us is clear, to give into our division or come together and rebuild our democracy. That rebuilding has begun. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Mark Trahant and Native Issues at IndianCountryToday.com. Coming up on Main Street, News Director Dave Thompson with a review of the week's big stories, and Matt Olin with his movie review for The Trial of the Chicago Seven. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A state senator who represents coal country says she's optimistic the legislature will pass a number of bills to help the lignite industry. Beulah Republican Senator Jessica Bell says the bills range from tax breaks for carbon capture and underground storage to changes in regulation. She says it might also help leverage federal funding for carbon capture.
And the big dream is that we would be able to use carbon dioxide in the Bakken to be able to extract even more oil from the Bakken as curves decline as we look to the future.
Bell says her constituents in coal country are very optimistic despite setbacks like the planned shutdown of the Coal Creek power plant near Underwood.
I think that's one of the things that I love most about coal country is that it's a resilient group, a hopeful group, and that even as we face a Biden administration, we can still see a pathway to success, to continue to do what it is that we love to do and provide energy for the nation.
Bell is the environmental manager for North American Coal's North Dakota operations. North American owns the Falkirk mine, which provides lignite for the Coal Creek Station. The ranking Republican on the U.S. Senate Ag Committee is warning that any more environmental exemptions granted to small refineries in the final days of the Trump presidency would badly harm the biofuels industry. Here's Harvest Public Media's Katie Pekus.
The bipartisan House Biofuels Caucus wrote to President Trump this week, saying more small refinery exemptions will cripple rural communities. And Republican Senator Chuck Grassley also opposes the exemptions.
Obviously, this would be a devastating blow to biofuel industry and to agriculture. At this time, however, these are just rumors, and I hope they stay just as rumors.
The EPA hasn't released an official decision. The agency has granted 85 waivers to small refineries since 2016. And the U.S. Supreme Court has decided to take up an appeal on a 2020 decision on the renewable fuel standard from a lower court. An appellate court ruled last year that the EPA overreached in granting waivers to three refineries. Katie Pekus, Harvest Public Media.
And investments in technology, longer school days, and extended school years could all be on the table as education officials search for solutions to learning loss. North Dakota School Superintendent Kirsten Basler says a drop-off in learning was anticipated due to the pandemic and the switch to distance learning models. Basler says test comparison with last fall and this fall illustrate how serious the situation is.
Roughly 27-28% of our students that were performing on grade level the fall of last year are below grade level this fall in reading, writing, and mathematics.
Basler told the House committee this week face-to-face instruction is critical moving forward. She says they also need to search for ways to accelerate learning.
Urban school districts already have summer school programs set up for both elementary, middle, and high school. Most often our rural school districts do not. They may have summer school for their high schools. And so the local school districts and their school administrators with school boards will make that decision about what their school calendars are.
Committee members asked Basler to develop recommendations for closing the learning gap. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Join Prairie Public Thursday, January 21st for a premier online screening and panel discussion of Esta es mi casa, This is My Home, Prairie Public's original documentary about the journeys of the Red River Valley's Hispanic communities. Generations ago, they came to help with the harvest. Today, their children and grandchildren contribute their own cultural stamp to our region's art, cuisine, diversity, and economy. That's Thursday, January 21st at 7 p.m. Central. Please RSVP for this online event at prairiepublic.org.
That wire machine in the background means it's Friday. Time to talk with our news director, Dave Thompson, who joins us about this time every Friday to look back at the week's big stories. Dave, we've still got COVID-19 out there.
We certainly do. The good news about COVID-19 is that the daily positivity rate is going down. It's down under 4% on a regular basis now. We're still seeing some deaths, and that's tragic too, but with the daily positivity rate going down and the vaccines coming to North Dakota and expanding who's going to be able to get the next round of vaccines, you know, this could be pretty good for the next few weeks at least.
Well, North Dakota seems to be leading the nation in a way in terms of the rate of its vaccines available and vaccines used.
I think we're in the top five.
Because there's 50-some thousand doses that have been given to the state and more than 40,000 have been administered. So that's looking pretty promising.
It is looking very promising. North Dakota has a good system already set up. They've been working on it for a while in order to get the vaccine out. It's probably not as fast as some people would like it to be, and it's following a tiered system that's suggested by the CDC, but you know, it's going to get there.
I also noted that of the testing that was done in the most recently, 48 of these were antigen tests, which means that these people had had the disease, may not have known it, but
that's
they
correct,
have the
yes.
antigens in their blood. So they were positive cases.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that. And I know that there are some pharmacies around that are starting to give these antibody antigen tests too.
Well, that's about one out of five were positive antigen tests. So
right.
Interesting. The Senate committee in the state legislature is listening to a bill to limit executive emergency powers. Is this a slap back at the governor or is this something else?
It actually is a slap back at the governor in a little bit because there are several bills that are now pending about emergency powers. The most egregious to me is the one that would basically prohibit a governor from ever implementing a mask mandate and basically would end the masks saying, you know, enough's enough. There's a companion bill to this one that talks about specifically health emergencies. So the real selling point to the one bill is that it would be the legislature could call itself back into special session, do it remotely, and have a seat at the table and weigh in. It would be similar to what Minnesota does. You know, the governor has an executive order. It has to be renewed every 30 days, and the legislature has to meet.
I'm just struck by that idea that no masks could be mandated.
That was an interesting bill that I saw, and I thought, oh, I can hardly wait to go to the hearing on that one.
Yeah, that's the ultimate politicization of mask wearing.
Mm-hmm.
Even though health experts say it's vital and it's important and it works, we can somehow say, well, politically it doesn't.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, we also note that in Myrdal's bill, she's offered an amendment that local governments could not impose their own tougher restrictions.
And that is interesting.
Yeah, that struck me too, because Fargo and other communities were out ahead of the governor on this.
That's right. Fargo, Grand Forks, and even Bismarck, who was reluctant to do it, actually came out a few days before the governor had his mandate in place. And now they're trying to – and I hate to say this, but an opponent of that bill said – These are people who like local control, except when they don't.
Okay. There's a barb there.
Yes. And that was somebody who said that to me. So,
Senator Mike Dwyer, a Republican from Bismarck, is talking about a bill to provide assistance to families with remote education expenses. He's got some personal experience with this.
He does. And it wouldn't affect him necessarily, but he has children who are teachers, and they have children. So they ended up watching the grandkids while these teachers were working from home. And it got him thinking that, okay, this is good, but what happens for a situation where you've got people who are working from home, they've got kids, but they don't have anything except a daycare they pay for, and the daycare is closed.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is going to try to provide a little financial help to people in that situation.
And it's a reminder that for school-age kids, school is daycare for a lot of parents.
Exactly it is. And I know, and this, you're going to hear about this story a little bit later on, but the superintendent of public instruction has been asked to take a look at what the state needs to do to catch some people up who may have fallen behind because of the virtual learning.
That's
so
a big deal.
That's going to be a huge, huge story.
We talked to Kirsten Baszler about that a while back, and
right.
She says there is real concern about it. They're going to be doing some testing, some special testing, to see where individual students are in terms of reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Right.
Okay, the Democrats in the state legislature, a distinct minority, are proposing a Human Services Stabilization Fund.
It's not the first time this has happened, but, you know, they had to make cuts a few years ago to human service programs, and they said, you know, we should do something, because they look at the budget stabilization fund, they look at the K-12 stabilization fund, and now the proposal for a higher education stabilization fund, and they said, hey, we don't want to cut human services, especially during a time of a pandemic. So they're looking at a proposal to see if they can create a pool of money that can be used to head off some of the cuts in human services should they have to be enacted.
And House Minority Leader Josh Boucher, a Democrat from Fargo, makes the interesting point that oftentimes human services funds are offset by the federal government. And if you don't have the fund, you can't get the federal money.
So you've got a double whammy on that.
Yeah.
And that's been talked about on a number of sessions about if we don't come up with the money, we're not going to get fully funded. It's kind of like the same thing happens with the highway program.
Dave, you had this story on Monday that really got me thinking. The North Dakota Public Service Commission wants to weigh in on utilities' integrated resource plans.
I thought that was extremely interesting. They want to charge the utilities and hire consultants to take a look at it and see what the plans actually look like and how it might affect other generation plans throughout North Dakota.
It sounds a lot like coal versus wind at the PSC level.
It could be. And let's be honest with you. There's a real move toward trying to find ways to keep lignite coal viable. I mean, they're talking about things like carbon sequestration, using that carbon that they save in underground storage for enhanced oil recovery, and trying to make lignite coal cleaner.
And, of course, the Coal Creek Station is set to go offline in 2022 unless a buyer is found sometime this summer, which is probably not real likely.
It may not be likely. I've heard there may have been some feelers from some companies, but what I hear is that they may not be so much interested in lignite coal, but they might be interested in some of the infrastructure around that plant.
Yeah.
So stay tuned for that, I guess.
The other interesting aspect of this PSC idea is that they want to get this report of these utility companies and their integrated resource plans 5 or 10 years ahead, which seems to me useful for giving the state a heads up as to, you know, whether or not there are going to be some coal plants or some other ways of generating power in the state according to the out-of-state interests that own the production.
Right, and you take a look at some of those companies, Xcel Energy, for example, or North American Coal. And we talked about the Coal Creek Station. That's Great River Energy, which is a Minnesota company. So, and there's a real move in Minnesota, as we all know, to go toward green energy. So
yes.
There's going to be some heated, maybe spirited discussions on this.
I think it's a national and international discussion as well.
Absolutely.
You had a story on Wednesday. There's an ethane power plant proposed for Northwest North Dakota. That might have a real benefit for Bakken production.
It is, because if you take a look, there's a power shortage still in the Bakken region. Secondly, ethane is not a very well accepted part of the natural gas stream because it burns too hot, and it's too hot to ship. And so they're taking a look and saying, well, we can use that in-state to generate power. And they're talking about a fairly large power plant. They're not ready to say what the nameplate capacity of that plant is, but they're talking hundreds of megawatts.
Well, let's talk about all these bills that are proposed for cars and transportation. A primary seatbelt law has been proposed in the legislature.
Not the first time. And the hearing was held earlier today at the Capitol, and I only had time to listen to the proponents because I had to go to another assignment. But the proponents were saying, look, the number one most preventable traffic death is the seatbelt, because a lot of these traffic deaths, people aren't buckled up and they get thrown out of a car. So they're trying to convince the legislature to finally pull the trigger and make it a primary enforcement thing. And today they decided to lower the fine from $50 to $20.
Okay. All right. A West Fargo lawmaker is proposing an 80-mile-per-hour speed limit on parts of I-29 and I-94. There's sort of been one in place informally for a long time.
That's very true. And I can tell you, in my trips to the western part of the state to do some hiking in the Badlands, I get back and I'm driving 75 miles per hour on the interstate. Oh, I counted 27 cars that have passed me last Sunday. So people are driving faster than 75. But he's saying that, you know, with the Highway Patrol and the Department of Transportation to sign off on it, they need to have some money to flatten out some of the curves and to put some guardrails between the lanes in some cases, you know, two lanes that way, two lanes the other way, and make it safer that way.
This is Representative Ben Koppelman, a Republican from West Fargo.
Yes.
So we'll see how that goes.
And he says I-29 is going to be just about ready to go.
And finally, there's a bill that would increase driver's training to 1 year for anyone under age 18.
Right. And the sponsor, who is a state representative from Grand Forks, says the reason why you do a year is that people can then, when they're learning how to drive, can learn to drive on different weather conditions as well as different surfaces. So you get some time on icy or snow-covered roads. You get some time on dry roads. You get some time on gravel roads or scoria roads, things like that.
Well, we'll see how the teenage lobby works around this one.
Yes.
Okay. We check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, every Friday. Always a pleasure, Dave.
Thank you, Doug.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight,
the siege of the Capitol, fueled by the president's own words.
You'll never take back our country with weakness.
The roots of rage run deep.
We could see it coming.
But how did we get here, and how do we repair what's been lost? American Reckoning, a PBS NewsHour special report.
Watch American Reckoning, a PBS NewsHour special report, tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt Olien. And Matt, this time we go to a sort of a historical film that some of us remember rather vividly. It's The Trial of the Chicago Seven.
Yeah, so written and directed by Aaron Sorkin, a very prominent writer that people know about.
The West Wing.
Yeah, he has a certain style. He knows how to write dialogue as good as anybody. It really crackles when you watch his movies, and now he's become kind of a director as well, directing his own material. And this is on Netflix right now. It was supposed to be in theaters in 2020, but of course, because of COVID, the production company decided to put it on Netflix. It is getting some Oscar buzz. I did like this movie a lot. Didn't love it completely. It takes some liberties with the facts and the timeline of things during the trial of the Chicago 7. Now, this, of course, is about the protests at the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, Doug, where people like Abby Hoffman and Tom Hayden and Jerry Rubin and some other fairly famous protesters, David Dellinger, were protesting the Vietnam War as Hubert Humphrey was being nominated for president to succeed Lyndon Johnson. Of course, he lost to Richard Nixon ultimately. And in the aftermath, as the Nixon administration takes over, the Department of Justice takes a very different attitude toward these protesters and decides to prosecute them as John Mitchell becomes attorney general, replacing Ramsey Clark, who had been LBJ's attorney general. So that's how the film really starts out, with Mitchell telling these lawyers, I want these guys prosecuted. And they hold a huge trial with seven or eight defendants. Bobby Seale is in on the trial as well from the Black Panthers, even though he had almost nothing to do with the protests at the 68 convention. That's an interesting sidelight to this whole thing, is Seale basically claiming, I had nothing to do with this. I don't know why I'm here. And the judge in the film is played by Frank Langella. And let's just say the judge makes some very strange rulings in this trial that clearly bias the defense. Really good performances. Mark Rylance plays William Kunstler, the lawyer for the defendants. I think Sacha Baron Cohen probably is the guy who's going to get an Oscar nomination out of this as Abby Hoffman. Eddie Redmayne, very good as Tom Hayden, who eventually became husband to Jane Fonda. And so Jeremy Strong is very good as Jerry Rubin. A lot of good supporting performances. Michael Keaton has an excellent cameo as Ramsey Clark, LBJ's attorney general. So the film moves very rapidly. It basically covers the trial, which lasts over 100 days. Bobby Seale is shackled at times in the courtroom by the judge because of his outbursts. And it's a fast-moving film. It's a long film. It's about 2.5 hours long, but I was never bored with it. I don't think it's Sorkin's best. If you put it up against some of his best writing, as I said, the timeline is adjusted for dramatic effect. There are some things that are out of sequence that happen. The culmination of the trial, a big moment, is kind of not handled in the factual way. But again, these are dramatic reenactments of a trial, and so As you know, dramatic license is often there with historical biographies. And the kind of the Black Panther aspect of the trial is the timeline there is out of whack as well. So a couple little discrepancies there that Sorkin's been criticized for. But overall, I think people will enjoy this movie. It's a really star-studded cast. I expect a couple Oscar nominations, probably more than a couple, actually, if you get into screenplay and some other things. But I think Sacha Baron Cohen is the guy they're kind of pushing for a supporting actor nomination.
Well, it's a vivid memory for me. I was on a college campus when that happened, and I do remember the riot, the TV coverage. It was something somewhat reminiscent to what happened in our nation's capital on Wednesday of last week. But that said, this involved a lot of Chicago police, a very belligerent mayor, Richard Daley, who was very upset about the Democratic convention in his Democratic city being disrupted by these young hoodlums, as he thought they were. It simply riveted the nation when it happened. And then the subsequent trial, again, was got headlines for a long time because the trial was so intrinsically interesting because of the behaviors of people like Abby Hoffman, for that matter, but also the judge, Julius Hoffman. He was highly controversial.
Very controversial. Yeah. And I don't want to give the ending away to people. If they're not familiar with the case of how it ends up, it's quite interesting how it ends up. You'll have to watch the film. One thing I liked about the movie, Doug, is they really get into intricate details of how they're defending the defendants, kind of the legalese of everything. They want to put the Vietnam War on trial, essentially, the defendants do. And so when something is well done on screen or on stage, Doug, even intimate, intricate details can be interesting. So Sorkin never dumbs down this story for the audience. It's very detailed as to the defense, how they're going to defend themselves. Abby Hoffman and Tom Hayden kind of buck horns, butt heads in this film as well. Kind of, they have different kind of views of how they're supposed to kind of come off to the jury, where Hayden cuts his hair, looks almost like a clean-cut college student. Hoffman is very vocal, very aggressive at the trial, so is Jerry Rubin. And Tom Hayden thinks they should come off differently, so that's kind of interesting how that is handled. I will say one of the things that maybe is a bit of a criticism for me, the actors do all seem to be a little too old for their parts, especially Sacha Baron Cohen, who's pushing 50, playing Abby Hoffman. But, you know, that's movies, right? There's movie logic and real-life logic. So in movie logic, I guess it all works. I think Eddie Redmayne does a really good job as Tom Hayden. And as I said, Mark Rylance is very good. And Frank Langella as the kind of crazy judge is very interesting as well.
I've got all those British actors playing Americans in a very important historic moment in our history, Chicago, 1968.
I should correct myself. Frank Langella's American.
This is one I'll look for, Matt. I look forward to seeing this movie, and I guess it's streaming online and Netflix, among other opportunities. Well, my Oscar trivia question is pretty simple this week. It's 1968. What movie won Best Picture in 1968?
So the you're talking about films released in 68 or the ceremony taking place?
The ceremony in 1968.
In the Heat of the Night would have gotten Best Picture.
All right. Another social issue that was very much in the forefront at that time. We've been to the movies with Matt Ali.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 15th. Meriwether Lewis and William Clark found many ways to occupy their time during the winter of 1804-05 at Fort Mandan near present-day Washburn, North Dakota. They met regularly with the neighboring Mandans and Hidatsa, with whom they traded, provided medical care, and shared dances and other gatherings. The men of the Corps of Discovery hunted the surrounding plains and tended to their watercraft. They also endured frostbite. In one of the most joyous moments that winter, Shoshone teenager and interpreter Sacagawea gave birth to a boy, Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau. Clark nicknamed the boy Pomp. Lewis helped hasten the boy's birth using rings of a rattlesnake's rattle, which were broken and mixed with water and given to Sacagawea, who was in painful labor. Minutes afterward, she delivered the boy. Lewis and Clark kept up with their journals during their three-year journey, though large gaps exist in Lewis's writing. On this date in 1805, they recorded observations of a total lunar eclipse. A total lunar eclipse is unusual, occurring on average about once every 6 years. The eclipse, seen from Fort Mandan, lasted between midnight and 3 a.m. Lewis had only the small refracting telescope of his sextant to observe the eclipse. Lewis also used a chronometer, a precision timepiece. Clouds obscured much of the eclipse, with its ending phases the most visible. Lewis and Clark used their observations of the eclipse and its phases for determining their longitude and the location of the native village, though Lewis had doubts about the accuracy due to the clouds. The following day, the weather wasn't bad at Fort Mandan. Snow began to melt. The wind shifted. Four Hidatsa dignitaries visited Lewis and Clark. Hunters brought meat for the expedition's men. The Corps of Discovery was in present-day North Dakota for 213 days over two separate visits, longer than their time in any other modern-day state that they traversed on the journey to the Pacific coast and back. And here's an item to look forward to in your own date book. The next total lunar eclipse visible in North Dakota will be on May 15th, 2022. Today's Dakota Date Book was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Donald Trump, the first president in the history of this country to be impeached twice. What does this mean for country and party? Also, a look at preparations in Washington, D.C. for Joe Biden's inauguration. And sea shanties become popular in these cooped-up times.
Soon may the wellerman come to bring us sugar and tea and rum.
Erg! Join us Saturday at Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and then after the broadcast or the stream, however you listen, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Monday on Main Street, we'll get an update on the pandemic from Dr. Donald Warren, the director of the Public Health and Indigenous Health Programs at the University of North Dakota. And we'll talk with Sarah Elmquist Squires about her new job as executive director of the North Dakota Newspaper Association. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.